This is Sam Sebrin, inviting you to drop in and tune in for this special edition of the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour. You will hear the voices of Dr. Timothy Leary, Amanda Fielding, Dr. Michael Persinger, Graham Hancock, Martin Lee, Terrence McKenna, Brad Burge, Charles Shaw, Hamilton Souther, and Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, plus cicadas, birds, cars, and legislative hearing outtakes that I recorded in Greene County, New York. As a lifelong seeker of higher consciousness in this material-based world, I'm happy to see recent renewed momentum toward legalizing research and use of psychedelics. This program looks at various breakthroughs in understanding the benefits of psychedelics, as well as the obstacles and motivations of a government prohibition in their war on our consciousness. Let's take a trip.
Why is it that each generation harasses and persecutes its gentlest, wisest, and holiest men? Exactly those men that succeeding generations will revere. The answer to this question has nothing to do with intelligence or social prejudice or conservatism. The answer is neurological. The nervous system of the adult human being is so set up that it registers intense neurological pain when confronted with an idea or method which liberates man from his addiction to symbols, from his addiction to the current tribal symbol system. The average American is heavily addicted to the symbolic level of consciousness, hooked to external tribal patterns, which he calls normal reality.
So this is why we call it a war. And it's a war on consciousness because it is about controlling how you think and act. And it comes at us not just through what we put into our bodies to expand our consciousness, but also what we receive directly through the internet, through television, through mass media in particular. Mass media is all about this stuff called perception management. It's about literally managing how you perceive things. It used to be called public relations, and before it was called public relations, it was called propaganda. And what it aspires to do is to keep you in the dark and keep you believing a myth, a cultural myth that binds you to the culture or the nation state. And with us, we've got a whole bunch of them in America, you know, and they're all fucking ridiculous if you actually like pick up a history book and start to look into them.
Consciousness is a closed loop. We have all this information going up into the cortex, but really, if we think at it quantitatively, only about 20% of the input to our cortex is sensory. All the rest of it is talk or interactions between those neurons, which means that consciousness is a closed loop, and sensory input is just a minor modification. Consciousness is actually created by this loop that is activated once every approximately 20 milliseconds with a phase modulation of about 12 milliseconds. That means if we change the neurochemistry within the cortices, we change the way you experience the world, we change your consciousness. So when we talk about psychedelics and psychotropic compounds influencing consciousness, remember one important thing. Again, to reiterate, structure dictates function. So the reason psychedelic drugs have an effect is because they indicate the brain's own chemistry. All of us have the capacity to make these compounds, or they wouldn't be effective. Some of us make more of these compounds than others, and we have different altered states all the time. And the fourth and most important feature is that anyone who can control consciousness, no matter who it may be, individual, political, group, can control consciousness by drugs, either illicit or condoned, control the population. because they control the sense of self.
And the interesting thing is that it's not the use of drugs that our culture is opposed to, obviously. Our culture encourages to a huge extent and markets drugs, and we are encouraged to take drugs and use drugs, not just alcohol and nicotine, but prescription medicines, painkillers, mood stabilizers, antipsychotics, all manner of substances that we're encouraged and told that we need in order to be healthy. So it's really just particular drugs and particular kinds of states of mind that have been criminalized over the last 100 years or so. And I think that's really an interesting point, because, you know, what are these states of mind that are being criminalized, and what is it that they're threatening such that they're being excluded?
Every time in the last few weeks that I've repeated this message, turn on, tune in, and drop out, I have been besieged by entreaties from my middle-aged friends. You can't say that, they tell me. But what I am saying is not reckless advice. It happens to be the oldest message of human wisdom. Look within, find your own divinity, detach yourself from social and material struggle. What is reckless is the American education system today, which puts young people on a mass assembly line geared to produce robots. American education does neurological damage. The schools and colleges of this country are designed and supported by parents who wish their children to become like them, which means like grandmother.
So it was really only since the 60s that psychedelics in particular have been criminalized. But the history of prohibition itself, the history of prohibition of substances and the criminalization of states of mind facilitated by psychoactive substances has a history that goes back to the late 19th century.
What the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, was doing with LSD when they first began experimenting with the drug the very early 1950s as part of the mind control research, the behavior control research that they were pursuing secretly. The most well-known program, at least became well-known later, it was secret while it was happening. It was called Operation MKUltra. It was actually an umbrella program that consisted of 149 different sub-projects that really looked at all areas of behavior control of interest to the CIA at the time, not just drugs, but electroshock, sensory deprivation, hypnosis. They tried all these different things in combination with various drugs. But the initial focus of those efforts was to try to find a truth serum, a truth drug, that they could use to make people talk and reveal information who would otherwise not be inclined to reveal that information. So various drugs and combinations of different techniques were initially tried in an effort to develop a truth drug, and eventually the CIA started using LSD for interrogation purposes as well. But there was some very intense, interesting research going on for 10 years before Leary finally got into it. And it was showing that LSD therapy, when given as an adjunct to psychotherapy, could be helpful in treating alcoholics, people with very psychologically resistant type of conditions. And it was considered a very hopeful tool in terms of psychotherapy until a controversy erupted in the early and mid-60s and LSD started to become associated with the emerging counterculture in the United States.
He used LSD to treat all sorts of complexes, and particularly alcoholism. Indeed, Bill Wilson, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, who took LSD in 1956 and had an experience which was totally spiritual, wanted to include LSD in the AA regime, but was dissuaded.
It's simply that the act of conscious self-inspection creates more conscious people, which create a more conscious society, which erodes the possibility of the poisonous and toxic effects of ideology. This is what psychedelics were and are about in terms of their social position and their legal position in society. psychedelics are illegal not because a loving government is concerned that you may jump out of a third-story window. Psychedelics are illegal because they dissolve opinion structures and culturally laid down models of behavior and information processing. They open you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong. And, you know, government and society spend a lot of money educating you into being a loyal worker, consumer, debt payer, and citizen.
After 50 years, it really has been proved that the war on drugs has failed. The prohibitionist approach has indeed caused more harms than it solved. And what I do with my organization is do kind of research on what other possible ways can we control and regulate the use of psychoactive substances, which will be more health, you know, more approach from a health aspect and less from a criminalization aspect.
Well, that's some legislation. He even hasn't done anything to make it any otherwise. What do you? Did anybody say he isn't doing a job? And how can you say that?
How do you make the determination?
The way the profit is being earned, the way the money that he's returning.
Having a felony conviction and having a drug conviction essentially makes you a second-class citizen. Although there isn't an official designation that puts you in a lower caste in the eyes of the government or the society, there is a cultural sentence that shoves you into a place, and there is a lot of social backlash that involves not being able to get a job, not being able to build a life, and living your entire existence with this kind of scarlet C for convict on your chest.
It's a kind of floodgate that cannot be successfully closed. It's the wrong policy, which is not only wasting billions of pounds and dollars, but it's also causing untold suffering. There are now 10 million people worldwide in prisons for drug offenses. And many of those people are just mere cannabis users. It's inhumane, our system, and also it's very unliberal and against the human rights of people to have the freedom to enjoy happiness and health, because it's an illusion to presume that everyone who consumes psychoactive substances are doing it in a way of misuse which damages their health. People for millennia have used these substances.
So for the lower classes, the poorer classes, which generally in this country are people of color, drug laws have always been used as a way to control them, right? It's a way of attacking a culture. It's a way of legally kind of removing a culture from a mixed space. So the first drug laws were in San Francisco in the late 1800s, meant to keep nice middle-class white women out of opium dens, because there was kind of an epidemic around the turn of the century with opium in household products and bored women sitting at home doing nothing but taking them all day long and getting strung out, right? Coca-Cola had cocaine in it, you know. It was a kind of an interesting time that ultimately led to the Harrison Narcotics Act in 1914, which is the first kind of global piece of drug policy that the U.S. tried to push on everyone else. It's important when we talk about war on consciousness and a war on drugs to understand that this battle's been going on for a very long time. And if you take away the distinction between tobacco and alcohol and cannabis and cocaine or alkaloids or whatever, what you've got is a war against altering consciousness. But what they are trying to stop more than anything is ideas, because what it is a war of ideas, and it is a war of control. Breaking away from an external control factor like a government or a religion or an ideology or an economy that enslaves you, and thinking outside the box and in revolutionary terms to try to solve it. It's no secret that psychedelics change consciousness. It's no secret that they're revolutionary. I mean, we've known this for a while. What is absolutely fascinating to me is how easily that culture was dismissed, so that today, a simple stereotype of a guy in a tie-dye saying something really weird will dismiss an entire hour of scientific research, vetted and proven, that a doctor can tell you about psychedelic medicine. One bad stereotype. And I believe, and I'm sure the people who lived through it believe, that this is a direct result of the propaganda that began with the right wing and Reagan in 1980 and was inculcated into now two generations. My generation is Gen Xers, and then the Echo Boomers, who've like grown up thinking that like hippies were stupid and Woodstock was crazy, and you know, we should just, if you do drugs, they're bad, and yada, yada, yada. And this whole idea of the word drug and the word substance and all this stuff, it's like it's all basic programming meant to change like how we look at the whole thing by casting it in moral terms. You know, it's not, it's a health issue, it's a biochemical issue, it's a metabolic thing more than anything else. Ultimately, all the substances you put in your body are catalysts towards natural reactions. So what are we really talking about here? How do we differentiate between this drug here and this drug here? And what it all boils down to is it profitable? Can it be patented? Can it be used for social control?
That's why you got all these beautiful people here. I know. They give up 2 years of their salary. It took a lump sum of $600.
I don't know. They
do. Mm-hmm.
We'll get it. When we get the
mail, but
don't forget. You know, really, the key difference between these major for-profit pharmaceutical companies that are pushing these drugs and the underground, massive, sprawling criminal organizations that fund wars in Central and South America, including Mexico and the southern United States, is that the pharmaceutical companies have lobbyists in Congress. They're both pushing drugs. They're both invested in a culture that encourages us to take drugs. And they're both making billions, if not trillions, of dollars from the sale of these drugs. So part of what MAPS is working towards, and the larger field of psychedelic researchers are working towards, is finding ways to combat that exact thing, to combat this reliance we have on prescription drugs. Now, it's interesting, and you might even think ironic, that we would be working in a pharmaceutical model, working with the FDA and other government regulatory agencies in a mainstream pharmaceutical development context with psychedelics to combat that very system. But in fact, that's exactly what we're doing. So we're at a point in human history now, just like apes might have been many hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago, where we're at a conflict between ourselves, our minds and bodies, and the outside world. We have massive industries and economies and wars around the world that are tearing this planet down and that are bringing us to a place where human life is not looking as sustainable as we would like it to be. And so we have these tools that have been available for thousands and thousands of years and only recently criminalized in the West, that there's a long history of them being used for causing or providing access to different ways of perceiving the world. And by doing that, by reestablishing ourselves and establishing a new relationship between ourselves, our bodies, and the environment in which we live, something that psychedelics can and have helped people do, we can change how we're living on this planet and make it more sustainable for ourselves and for future generations. So I think this idea that psychedelics can help precipitate a profound change in awareness leading to an evolutionary leap of sorts, I think it's a really, really powerful idea. And the key there being that they have to be used in particular ways, and they have to be used carefully and responsibly in order to help produce these beneficial changes in awareness. So I think, again, we're at this place in history and culture where we're moving forward and reestablishing our relationships, and psychedelics may be able to help us do that.
We have witnessed an astonishing expansion and elevation of human consciousness in this country, and an equally predictable reaction of panic and anguish against this psychedelic revolution. What we were running into was the oldest law in the history of human knowledge. It always takes one generation for a new idea to become accepted. The imprinted symbol systems of the older generation cannot tolerate and indeed shriek with neurological pain at any idea or method which promises to change the game.
The other side of that is the toxicity of ideology. That ideology itself is poisonous. That in the 15th and 16th century, it's like 120 years of intermittent religious war because people were so uptight about whether or not you were a Catholic or a Huguenot or a Walloon or, you know, all the stuff, which were, these were life and death issues. And finally, people just became sick of it. And I choose to believe that we may be approaching such a watershed with the social ideologies that have just been dinging themselves into the global population for the past 100 years. They are extremely bankrupt. The notion of any kind of serious competition between Marxist-Leninism and capitalist democratic techno-fascism or whatever it is ludicrous. Neither system works in the presence of the need to wage ideological warfare against the other. And yet it's fairly clear that each society could function quite well if it didn't have that burden. And similarly, in many microcosms of that situation around the world, it's clear that ideology has become some kind of anachronism. It's a kind of lack of good taste. It's like being a nut, you know, so that you come on with some ideology and people just look at their plate. They're embarrassed for you. And well, they should be, because that butter's no bread. That's just a big pain in the neck. The ideology which naturally claims our attention is pretty well understood. You know, it's like it says in the Old Testament, you can know the truth. The truth is the still small voice in your heart. We don't have to take courses in theology and ethics to get all this down. The political agenda is fairly clear. You know, you feed people, you cure disease, you anticipate and solve social problems having to do with sewage disposal, distribution of land and wealth, so forth and so on. I mean, who's kidding who? None of this stuff is controversial unless you're living inside a locked ward, which we seem to be doing.
Okay, this is on local introductory law number 4. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to call this public hearing to order. The purpose of this public hearing is to hear comments from the public regarding local law introductory number 4. Hearing no one, This hearing is closed, and the next one will start at 7:30.
I'm suggesting actually that vision involves an outward projection of images. What you're seeing is in your mind, but not inside your head. Our minds are extended beyond our brains in the simplest act of perception. I think that we project out the images we're seeing, and these images touch what we're looking at. If I look at you from behind, you don't know I'm there. Could I affect you? Could you feel my gaze? There's a great deal of evidence that people can. The sense of being stared at is an extremely common experience, and recent experimental research suggests it's real. Animals seem to have it too. I think it probably evolved in the context of predator-prey relationships. Prey animals that could feel the gaze of a predator would survive better than those that couldn't. This would lead to a whole new way of thinking about ecological relationships between predators and prey, also about the extent of our minds. If we look at distant stars, I think our minds reach out in a sense to touch those stars and literally extend out over astronomical distances. They're not just inside our heads. Now, it may seem astonishing that this is a topic of debate in the 21st century. We know so little about our own minds that where our images are is a hot topic of debate within consciousness studies right now.
In time, the supremacy of the word led to analytic and dialectic thought processes. And indeed, it is these that have been the foundations of our scientific and technological advances. Western man has been so awestruck by these successes that he has become tunnel-visioned, putting all his faith into reason, argument, and analysis. The result of this great faith in empirical knowledge is that we dismiss as superstition, fantasy, or chance all those things that cannot be explained by our current knowledge base. Although LSD is the product of Western scientific thought, its actions in the brain widen our perception, lighting up parts of the brain that are normally in slumber. I would hope that by combining modern scientific and analytic techniques with the broader fields of perception gained through heightened consciousness, we could learn more about those areas, both inside the brain and out, that are beyond our current materialistic knowledge base. By learning more about the brain, by following the Delphic instruction to know thyself, we can shortcut the slow changes brought about by evolutionary mutations and improve the functioning of the brain by clever manipulation. Many predict that the 21st century will be the century of neuroscience. Humanity's ability to alter its own brain function might well shape history as powerfully as the development of metallurgy in the Bronze Age and mechanization in the Industrial Age. Now our growing ability to alter brain function can be used to treat mental dysfunction in people who are ill and to enhance some mental processes in healthy individuals. Indeed, the concept of enlightenment, literally the bringing of light to the mind, might be seen in scientific terms as the increase in the oxidation of glucose, itself the encapsulation of the energy of sunlight. Thus, the expansion of consciousness can be viewed as the flooding of the mind with the extra light of increased metabolism. There is good evidence that LSD increases the sense of spirituality. The Beckley Foundation is currently involved in research to explore how the use of psychedelics may increase the experience of the mystical, both in high-level meditators and non-meditators. We are also investigating the mechanisms underlying the mystical experience and how it compares to those similar experiences triggered by psychedelics.
Science delusion is the belief that science already understands the nature of reality in principle, leaving only the details to be filled in. This is a very widespread belief in our society. It's the kind of belief system of people who say, I don't believe in God, I believe in science. It's a belief system which has now been spread to the entire world. But there's a conflict in the heart of science between science as a method of inquiry based on reason, evidence, hypothesis, and collective investigation, and science as a belief system or a worldview. And unfortunately, the worldview aspect of science has come to inhibit and constrict the free inquiry, which is the very lifeblood of the scientific endeavor. Since the late 19th century, science has been conducted under the aspect of a belief system or worldview, which is essentially that of materialism, philosophical materialism. And the sciences are now wholly owned subsidiaries of the materialist worldview. I think that as we break out of it, the sciences will be regenerated.
And so when I was there, standing behind this table, talking about this research that's really looking for a cure rather than just prolonged symptom relief or just keeping people on drugs for the rest of their lives, by and large, treatment providers, therapists and psychiatrists, physicians, were intrigued. And they wanted to know, based on the results that I explained earlier, you know, when they could use MDMA in their practice. There's such a need for better treatments that work, and such a frustration on the part of psychiatrists with the pharmaceutical companies that are really failing us in a lot of ways, that they're ready for something new. And I think psychedelic research can bring something new to medical practice in that way. I see psychedelics as a tool, as a very, very powerful tool, a power tool, if you will, that can be used responsibly and it can be used carelessly. And we need policies and procedures and attitudes that can help us use them safely.
I believe LSD enables the blood to reach parts of the brain usually closed off from function. It widens the interconnectivity of the neurons by supplying more energy. It is the most valuable tool to alter the mind of man so we are better able to study ourselves and and the external world. LSD could turn out to be a most valuable aid in neuroscience and psychiatry. Exploring brain function only from the normal state of consciousness may be denying us a vital new lens with which to explore the complexities of the mind. Einstein was right when he said, "No problem can be solved with the same consciousness that created it." We need to step outside the box in order to truly see what is going wrong. LSD may well be the tool psychiatry has been waiting for, particularly in today's climate of global neurosis and the need for cost-effective healthcare. Psychedelics, when used in a controlled clinical setting, can be safe and effective means to reduce inhibitions, increase the recall of repressed memories, loosen the ego, and facilitate the free flow of hidden feelings.
Okay, now, in typical Western views of shamanism, they play a dualistic game called ordinary consciousness, non-ordinary consciousness. This is ordinary because we have a tremendous amount of time associated with it saying this is what's normal, and now that's altered. I would rather transcend that definition and look at consciousness as being bound to what we're experiencing in that very moment, and saying that we're not in an altered state, we're in our state. We are in consciousness, and now consciousness is looking like this whole expression, and we're going to continue in that expression, and we're going to come into new expressions of consciousness, and we're never going to go back to what was. We're never going to go from ordinary to non-ordinary to ordinary. By the time you get back to that idea of ordinary, things have changed, and that's the whole purpose of the transformative journey in ayahuasca. That you're going to have a transformative experience, so you're not going to come back to ordinary, but you are going to come back to sane, lucid, stable, clear, aware, and present in a way to be able to function with physical reality. Okay? So we transcend that idea of ordinary, non-ordinary, and we go into an idea of consciousness, expansion of consciousness, pursuit of learning about consciousness, growth in consciousness. All right, so then the effects of ayahuasca can be wide. And so when we try to pin down what is ayahuasca and what is common to ayahuasca, we find that we can't. We just can't. And so we don't have to. We can just stop that whole pursuit and just say, what we're really doing is continuing to explore beyond our understanding. We're continuing to go into the unknown and finding and discovering new realizations and understandings and transformations and healings through that pursuit.
And it's an untold story, really. Ayahuasca has been fantastically successful in getting people off harmful addictions to hard drugs such as heroin and cocaine. Jacques Mabit at the Takiwasi Clinic in Peru brings heroin and cocaine addicts out there for a month, gives them 12 ayahuasca sessions, and they have encounters with Mother Ayahuasca during those sessions that lead them not to wish to take heroin or cocaine anymore, and more than half leave completely free of their addiction, never return to it, and don't even have withdrawal symptoms. And the same incredible healing work was being done in Canada by Dr. Gabor Mate until the Canadian government intervened and stopped his healing practice on the grounds that ayahuasca itself was an illegal drug.
If one questions it, new forms of research, new possibilities open up. And I think as we question these dogmas that have held back science so long, science will undergo a reflowering, a renaissance. I'm a total believer in the importance of science. I've spent my whole life as a research scientist, my whole career. But I think by moving beyond these dogmas, it can be regenerated once again and become interesting and, I hope, life-affirming.
We're continuously sold the line that somehow when the metaphors of consciousness are fully mapped onto quantum physics and biology, that there, a great step forward will have been taken. It seems to me that since the information coming out of quantum physics and molecular biology is so removed from the realm of common experience, that if we succeed in mapping mental phenomena onto those realms, we will have succeeded in the final act of alienation. because we will have at last totally removed our experience of ourselves from the realm of felt cognition. So I think that instead of the idea that there needs to be a kind of direction of an overarching metaphor from the physical sciences into the social and psychiatric sciences, instead there should be the recognition and celebration of mystery, that in fact we are an intelligent species caught in a historical process. No generation which preceded us knew what was going on, and there is no reason to assume that we know what's going on or that the generation which follows us will know what's going on. And what kind of trip is it anyway to insist on knowing what's going on? It's a highly unlikely enterprise. I mean, look at the data sample. The data sample is your lifetime on one planet in one tiny corner of the universe. And from this, via the fallacy of induction, certain principles of uniformity are extended to the far-flung corners of the cosmos and space and time. Then a bunch of fancy metaphors are built up that nobody can check on anyway. And then this is called understanding. You see, it isn't understanding. Understanding issues into appropriate activity. And you know, a model of the universe which doesn't issue into appropriate activity in the here and now is a curious model indeed. After all, appropriate activity in the here and now, I would think, would be the sine qua non. Everything else is an unconfirmed rumor. So nature is the visible manifestation of this mystery. It entirely surrounds and completes us. It is there to be beheld and imbibed in. It is simply that one must either replace the sterile language of scientific materialism, or one must bring no language whatsoever to it so that it speaks for itself. I've noticed with ayahuasca, this South American visionary vine that's a hallucinogen, unlike the mushroom, it does not speak. It shows, its language is visible, a fractal hieroglyphic surface of intermediate dimensions that contains an endless unfolding of phenomena at level after level, apparently, you know, who knows, down into the microphysical realm. This is a correct seeing of what is. The mystery is co-present with its denial. It is a matter of changing points of view. And changing points of view is a matter of retooling language.
And it becomes an exploration of what it is to live, or what it is to experience, or what it is to perceive. And at that point, the shamanism becomes a guide, and the ayahuasca becomes a guide for an exploration of the purity of consciousness. Now, that consciousness that we're exploring is your own. It's your own consciousness. Found within that consciousness is every experience that you've ever had, all of your memories, all of your concepts, all of the time, all of your creation stories, all of your myths, all of your beliefs, all of your ideologies. Everything's found within it, everything that makes up you.
The better understanding of the brain deserves nothing less than the most systematic and thorough exploration. The sad fact is that because of the excesses of a minority of users in the 60s, governments overreacted by prohibiting scientific research into these substances, as well as their use. The baby was thrown out with the bathwater. Now it is time to resume serious scientific research into how psychedelics may be able to help treat the ills of troubled mankind and expand our knowledge of the workings of the brain. Since research with psychedelics was prohibited, the art of brain imaging has grown exponentially, and there have been huge advances in neuroscience. Serotonin was discovered shortly after LSD, and more recently other neurochemicals, such as anandamide and the endorphins. The urge to alter consciousness is innate and as old as humankind. We now know that the means of altering consciousness originate in the human nervous system. External drugs just make use of internal mechanisms. In the small kingdom of Bhutan, high up in the Himalayas, the most important official statistic is not gross national product, but gross national happiness. It is possible that learning how to enhance consciousness would increase happiness. The laws and customs of a society need to be based on common sense and justice. At the present time, the potential value of psychedelics has been airbrushed out of the scientific and medical cornucopia. Let's open the doors to research. Should the results of the research endorse the numerous positive self-reports, then Albert's inspired premonition in 1943 will be free to reap its full benefit for struggling mankind. By encouraging a creative stream of energy to illuminate the path through the fog. Thank you, Albert, for being the one you are and for having been the initiator of so much enlightenment.
And it makes it an unlimited exploration of life.
There's a war on consciousness in our society, and if we as adults are not allowed to make sovereign decisions about what to experience with our own consciousness while doing no harm to others, including the decision to use responsibly ancient and sacred visionary plants, then we cannot claim to be free in any way, and it's useless for our society to go around the world imposing our form of democracy on others while we nourish this rot at the heart of society and we do not allow individual freedom over consciousness. It may even be that we're denying ourselves the next vital step in our own evolution by allowing this state of affairs to continue, and who knows, perhaps our immortal destiny as well.
Should have been immediately following his previous.
You've been listening to the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour, created and produced by Sam Sebrin for Free 103.9's Transmission Arts Programming, broadcast on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre. Until next time, happy trails.
This gives an interesting new twist to the term high.
Because of prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.